Wisconsin-Madison Archives Oral History Project. We are going to talk about your writing of the history of WRF, how it came about and how you went about it and what happened to it.
Well, very briefly, with the approach of the 60th anniversary of the founding of WRF, there was a recognition on the part of some board members that it would be good to have an updated chronicle. There had been several previous histories, although it was interesting that the latest one, which corresponded to the 40th history of WRF, written by an in-house person by the name of Abram, reached the page proof stage in type and then was filed. But anyway, the board, through Walter Frautschi, asked Chancellor Shane to ask me to undertake writing a 60-year history. I, having just retired, and I was delighted to accept the assignment. And I was given total access to the total WRF files, which are voluminous. And I had the aid of the WRF librarian, who was a very dedicated person and who had kept interminable scrapbooks of clippings. Fortunately, 10 years before, Emeritus President Fred had undertaken to write a salute to WRF, and in doing so had a stable of research assistants who also went through WRF files, went through the archives, and compiled a series of, as I recall, 10 loose-leaf folders roughly representing various elements of the WRF history. And those were in existence, and I had access to them. There is a great deal about WRF in the university files, so it can be approached from that direction.
The archives, you mean?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I would hope that in time, given a what I'll call a reputable historian, which I am not, WRF could be persuaded, probably under some restrictions, for an official historian to have access to the WRF library. The one problem is that the total files obviously include current negotiations and contracts, which, because of the licensees, have to be classified. And that covers the 17-year period of a patent. So there are valid reasons for putting some clamps on an historian, although I must say there were absolutely none imposed on me, other than the suggestion that if I were going to get into current negotiations, I better come and check to see whether I was revealing anything that would be, well, how can you put it, I suppose, subject to WRF being sued for revealing what is patently in the public interest as classified. So I simply went to work, and I had a stable of UW consultants that I used at various stages I've already mentioned John Jenkins, who is currently engaged in drafting various aspects of university history as a sequel to Curdy and Karstensen.
Well, you mentioned him before we were on the tape,
right.
So you might say how you used him.
Well, since John Jenkins was writing increments of the post-1925 history, a period that obviously coincided with the emergence of Worf, I was concerned that aspect of what I was writing be accurate. So John volunteered to read every draft, and indeed did. I used Ira Baldwin extensively because of his intimate relationship with the whole evolution. I ran everything past Art Hovey, just in case I was contaminating university policy in some way. I ran everything past Bob Bach, Dean of the Graduate School, who I might say was not particularly helpful. I ran the final drafts past Bry Curl, as a fellow journalist, really, and as a longtime university administrator, and Bry was extremely helpful. Mm-hmm. And the final draft, just to double check that, again, I was not jeopardizing any university positions. This was a hangover of my own administrative days. Irv Shane saw the full manuscript and made a few comments. Fred Harvey Harrington saw it, because I was interested in his reactions, and got many, all very helpful. Ed Young saw it and gave me extensive verbal comments and nothing in writing, which speaks volumes to the two techniques of the two presidents. There may have been some other people, and they are duly recorded in the acknowledgments. Obviously, John Pike, the executive director of Worf, saw every line, and the board saw they saw a draft on which those who were in a position to commented extensively. Remember, the majority of the board was not a party of the history and knew nothing of it, so their comments were subjective and all favorable. The members of the board who went back to the tenuous days made significant comments, all of which I incorporated. So, there was a conversation at that final board meeting that has never been revealed to me, there is nothing substantive in the history that the Worf board takes exception to. It is simply their congenital reluctance to live in the public eye. I find this, as a professional PR man, an anathema, but they're the board. Now, they did authorize me to bring out a sanitized little summary folder. You've probably seen that.
I have, yes.
And that's as complete and accurate an update as you're going to get, I guess. and it's better than nothing. And it was sent to, it was distributed widely in the university, simply to bring, well, really two generations of faculty up to speed as to what WRF is. Now, it's possible that changing times and changing attitudes and changing key university administrators will bring a modification in WRF policies. It's quite possible that the university, as a salute to WRF, would choose to bring out a history of WRF so that it didn't sound like it was WRF tooting its own horn, which was one of the board objections, even though the history is not a whitewash by any means.
But that was one of the board did object to that, or felt that they were tooting their own horn.
I don't know. I'm just guessing. WRF, except for publicity associated with promoting patented products and the research institute, WRF hasn't put out anything on its own since 1936. It's interesting that in its early days, Harry L. Russell, the first director, put out a fulsome annual report, culminating in a 10-year report in 1936. He drafted a 1937 report, and that reposes in the files. So this antipathy to overt messages goes way back. Now, I should say that in 1946, at the height of one of the intense drubbings that WRF has taken in the public press, WRF asked the Wisconsin Alumni Association to come to its defense. I happened at the time to be editor of the Wisconsin Alumnus.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you may have seen what resulted. It was an extensive story in the Alumnus called The WRF Story, and it was jointly authored by Ward Ross, who was then the executive director, and me as the Wisconsin alumni editor. Now, that was a pure whitewash.
Yeah.
Well, I shouldn't say that. It was a direct response to the charges that were floating around, which were voluminous, and in this case stemming from an assistant attorney general of the U.S. Who had vilified WRF in a book on cartels and restraint of trade, one chapter of which was WRF. And this was a direct refutation of those charges and others. Then in 1948, a freelance writer for Reader's Digest picked up that old story and ran a vicious attack in Reader's Digest. WRF threatened to sue. The editor of Reader's, or the publisher of Reader's Digest, was a Wisconsin alumnus, and he caused a distinguished science writer, Paul DeCreef, to write a total rebuttal. Probably one of the few times in the history of American journalism that this has ever happened.
Yes.
The Cap Times has always been a burr under WRF's saddle. Beginning at the time WRF was created, Bill Evue took a violent exception to these Republican capitalists threatening to contaminate the wellsprings of university thought. And Bill never let him off the hook right up until I think the latest was in the 60s. Worf had about a semi-annual expose of Worf. So this accounts for, to a great degree, to the what you can only call the paranoia of the Worf board.
Mm-hmm.
On several occasions, the university has filled in the gaps with never-ending feature stories and indeed two different publications glorifying Worf.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't that there aren't documents.
Bill Jordan, was that one of those? Was his?
Well, Bill did an update of E.B. Fred's.
Oh.
And then Jim Larson did two different. Well, one was on the occasion of, I guess it may have been Bill Jordan, too, the 50th anniversary of Worf.
Mm.
The grad school staged a big banquet and had a movie. So it is not a secret story, but it hasn't had the kind of continuing overt public information that you would normally expect and that you see from a foundation like Ford or Rockefeller,
mm-hmm.
or so on.
Mm. And none of the drama of what happens on the Worf board and the decisions they have to make. That never comes out in any of these whitewashes.
Well, I don't know that there's anything that deleterious, actually. I had access to the board minutes,
mm-hmm.
and they're voluminous. They're all carefully edited, of course, as are the minutes of the Board of Regents. That's just standard.
Mm-hmm.
But you can read between the lines and know there have been real contentions.
I wonder if you knew about the effort by Jan van Cina to write a history of Worf, which I unearthed in one of the, probably in Harrington's files on Worf. So, the hope was that they could get Vernon Carstensen to do the actual writing.
I never heard of this person, Van Cina. I do know that, although to my knowledge it never reached board consideration, there was some negotiation with Vernon.
Oh, well, that must be the same thing.
To write not just the history of Worf, but a history of the emergence of the university as a research university, which obviously would include Worf.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that broke down because of Vernon's unavailability or of university lack of funds,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. There was another attempt when Ward Ross resigned as executive director. Ward, who was very close to John Paul Link. Carl Paul
Link.
Proposed to write a history, a biography of Carl Paul, which would inevitably bring the Worf history up to date. And that broke down. And the record is not clear whether it was Ward running out of gas or the board reluctant to fund it. And I did not consider it worth pursuing. After all, my mission was not to investigate abortive wharf histories.
Yes, to make up for them.
Right. So those are the... Now, at the encouragement of E.B. Fred, Bob Taylor interviewed Harry Steenbach at length and wrote a memorandum for the record, which you've probably seen. That's in the archives. That may have been at Harry's request that he wanted professional help in recording his remembrances. Then, of course, you can approach it through Ingram's biography of Flichter. The biography of Harry L. Russell. Those are key documents. The biography of E.B. Fred is limited to his role as a biochemist, as you may know. So there is nothing about Wharf in there other than recording the fact that E.B. was the recipient of the very first Wharf grant, as you may know, in 1928. And incidentally, that the 60th anniversary of that is coming up, and that might be the occasion for resurfacing this question of
publishing.
Right.
Question just then. So you don't think that there is anything in what you wrote, but again, I'm at a real inconvenience for not having read it. What I am wondering about the history is whether, to what extent you include in it serious issues that arose, for instance, the quarrel between Steenbach and Link, and well, I'll have to go back and review my notes of my interview with Walter Frauchi. Did you discuss that kind of thing?
Where it impinged on the Wharf record, yes. So there's a little bit about the Steenbach Link warfare. I think that's the only term you can use. Where it involved Link presenting to the board his story of Steenbach attempting to block certain developments.
The vitamin K.
Right. But nothing beyond that. I didn't think it was pertinent to a Wharf history to air all that other dirty linen.
Well, do you have anecdotes in it, such as the trip to Chicago to the board meeting? Walking Steenbach around in the city while Link was making his presentation. Did you find that kind of thing in the archives?
Well, knowing what the story was, I could find it in the minutes.
I see, yes.
But that, right or wrong, I considered that peripheral. It's fascinating, I wasn't writing a history of professorial intrigues.
Yeah.
And it had no direct bearing on anything that Wharf Board did.
Except that they did turn down the vitamin K, which is of interest.
Well, that's debatable.
Whether it's of interest or not?
No.
Or whether they turned it down?
No, they turned it down, but it's debatable whether the decision had anything to do with Link and Steenbuck.
Oh, is it?
That's the way I read the record.
Hmm. So you discussed that in the history?
At no length.
Uh-huh. It the way it's presented in the newspapers, there were newspaper accounts of
sure.
it.
Sure.
It seemed rather significant if one could give people aspirin without having them hurt their stomachs, that it would be a very useful thing to do. And you're also told, I guess also in the news accounts, that Steenbuck had ordered the board more or less not to approve it.
I don't read that in the record.
You don't?
No. Well, he ordered them not to do it, but I don't read the record as the Wharf Board rolling over and playing dead.
Uh-huh.
After all, they had all kinds of independent counsel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very convoluted situation.
Mm-hmm. I see. So the newspaper picks up and interprets it one way that has sure. nothing to do necessarily with the facts.
Sure. And here again is a prime example of Wharf standing mute, not laying its position on the public record.
I see, yeah.
So what you get, particularly in the Cap Times, is largely the Link story.
Yes, yes.
And remember, Link and Bill were very close friends. Bill Evue.
Mm-hmm. Did it occur to you in writing the history to give the Wharf side of this story so as to counteract what had been said in the newspapers?
No. I considered this so minute an issue.
You did?
Mm-hmm. Right or wrong?
Well, it might have been this, the result of it might have been minute, but it was a major issue in that it gave the outside something to criticize Wharf
sure.
for, and that's one of mm-hmm. the major things Wharf has to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, you make arbitrary decisions, and that was one.
Yeah. Oh, is the University Houses story in
sure.
in there?
Mm-hmm.
That seems to have been rather a tense period, tense issue also.
In what way?
One of the board members felt that Wharf money should not be used for any but life science or science researchers. And since other people would be living in the houses besides scientists, he felt the money shouldn't be used that way. And then Brittingham, I believe it was Brittingham, decided to charge the university just 1% interest. Do you remember all of this?
Mm-hmm.
Is this in the history? So you know it better than I do, presumably.
Again, I didn't go into great lengths with this. Where did you get that?
From the president's files again.
Curious. Well, let me tell you, want to
yes,
the story as
I'd
I understand
like
it? Well,
if you'll excuse me, I'll turn the tape.
E.B. Fred and I'm sure others anticipated the housing crunch that would occur with the end of World War II. Some of them from personal experience, like E.B. Freds himself, having been a World War I lieutenant and coming back, having a tough time finding
yeah,
an apartment
yes.
again. He and others persuaded the board, I guess about in 44 they started talking to consider building a what today we would call a condominium project for faculty housing, for young faculty housing. Primarily, I'm sure, although this doesn't show in the WRF records, to make sure that they could refill the natural science staffs. Because after all, the basic WRF mission is to support university research, and if you don't have researchers, there's nothing to support. At any rate, in one of what I think is one of its more brilliant decisions, the WRF board set up University Houses Incorporated to build what we know as university houses, 150 condominium units.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two crucial decisions that had to be made. One was how can we meet our fiduciary responsibilities, that is, make money. We can't just give this thing away willy-nilly. Our mission is to make money to support research. And the other one, it was, who's going to get in here? Who's going to live there? The first was resolved, the fiscal decision was resolved that WRF would only make a cent and a half, 1.5% interest, which was below, but not that much below. See, that was in the day of 4% money,
so
it wasn't any gross malfeasance. But that was made, as I understand it, kind of by the executive committee, principally by George I. Haight, that they were only going to charge a cent and a half so the rents could be as low as possible. That was the goal. And it was Brittingham who objected. It wasn't.
Okay, I've got it, yeah.
Because Tom
was off at a meeting, off in the West somewhere.
No, the decision was made in the West. At the Bohemia Club, which is a very exclusive place, and Tom wasn't there. Tom was livid when he found out about this. This was a gross crime, well, not a crime, but it was not living up to the board's responsibility. This was giving money away.
Yes.
And what was worse, anybody was going to live there. Just when that decision was made, I don't know, but I went very carefully over the department affiliations of the first residents. I was particularly interested because I was one of them.
Yeah.
And anybody got in. There were no departmental restrictions. In fact, in the unit that I joined, it was remarkably even between the biological sciences, the physical sciences, the social sciences, and the humanities were all equal, plus three professional school people, two ROTC instructors, and one assistant football coach. Now, you can't get more eclectic than that. But Tom Brittingham was, Tom resigned from the board.
Yes.
Tom resigned.
That's right.
To make a long story short, running university houses didn't turn out to be WRF's dish. It was a pain in the butt. To some extent, it was poorly designed. They had borrowed lock, stock, and barrel a development going up at Fairfax, Virginia, which didn't have any basements. And so every sixth building had a basement where the laundry facilities were. Well, there were all kinds of physical plant management problems. They picked as the resident manager an ex-first sergeant, literally by the name of Rockwell, and then you get these 150 faculty members all back from overseas, most of them officers. And obviously they formed a city council, and well, Worf just decided enough of this stuff. And what was it, 1951, they gave the whole darn thing to the university, $2.4 million, the biggest single gift they'd ever given, with one proviso. They're going back now to their classic position. Profits from university houses were to go to support research in, quote, the natural sciences, unquote.
They actually say that.
Yeah. So that's where you get the university houses professorships. They're now called something else, but that's the houses story. There's another interesting sidelight to that that I think is worth recording. And I came in on this in 1946, wound up half-time assistant to Mr. Fred. Where were you going to put university houses? Well, we've got this ag property out there, Eagle Heights, beef farm, orchards. Don't have to pay for the land, let's put it out there. Well, the ag school bitched because they thought that's our land, you know, you're cannibalizing our farm. And the good people of Shorewood objected. You were going to have all these snotty-nosed kids contaminating Shorewood schools.
Yeah.
And Class B residential abutting our Class A. E.B. was visited by a committee of Shorewood residents, all of whom were faculty members, distinguished faculty members. Harold Bradley, Chet Rudicelli, Andy Hopkins, Ernie Bean. You can't build that out there, Mr. Fred. And I happened to have been there. This is a classic performance on E.B.'s part. He said, gee, I'm glad to see you because I've got a problem, he said. You know, the ag school says that's their land. He said, he reached in his drawer and he said, you know what they want to build out there? He said, they want to build an experimental hog farm. Harold Bradley got this silly little grin on his face and said, Mr. Fred, I think we'd better have the apartments. So, the university made a quasi-legal deal. The state can't pay taxes, couldn't pay taxes to Shorewood. But obviously, all these grad student or instructor kids were going to impact the Shorewood schools, so they worked out a deal. University houses water is Shorewood water at the time. So the university agreed to pay an exorbitant water bill to fund the schools.
So that did that come out of the wharf of the university houses income or
sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. But the houses I think they made an immediate dramatic impact on recruiting. on recruiting faculty.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Just the stunning impact. Having been there, I know unit after unit occupied by young people who wouldn't have come at all except for housing.
Mm-hmm.
You may have forgotten how desperate the housing situation was. And the alternative was riding a bus from Badger. What also resulted was you had the greatest interdisciplinary mix imaginable, with all these departments represented cheek by jowl, and all their kids intermingling and intermingling at garden plots,
mm-hmm.
and interminable potluck suppers. So there was a whole generation of faculty whose closest friends were university houses buddies, not departmental colleagues. Whether that is still as viable, I don't know, but the interdisciplinary stance of Madison is a decided cut above that of comparable institutions, and a great deal of it in the last 40 years has been due to the fact that so many people knew so many people just because they lived, lived together.
That's interesting. Do you, who was there when you were living there?
Well, I'll give you an example. I lived between Werner Sumi and Jim Crow.
My goodness.
In the next building was Lee Epstein, Bob Crane, Will Steedy. Across was Ed Young, Ralph Hewitt, Frank Remington, Scott Cutlip. Bry Curl was just down the line, Bob McCabe. It was what became the university power structure. Reed Bryson was up the road.
That's very interesting.
Oh, sure. And today, these are my friends. I know those people 10 times better than I know my journalism colleagues. And that was just the way it is.
I've never heard that.
Oh yeah, you've got to tell that.
That's very important.
Oh,
isn't it?
Classic. I have a paragraph on this.
In the book.
Yeah.
And you list those people, do you?
No. I've verbalized this to John Jenkins, and in his history, the dorms inherited university houses. So John is going into this a bit. But it would be quite striking to go back as you could and get the 1948-1950 university houses roster, which is in the archives.
And
what you have, with practically no exceptions, are the named professors of 30 years later. And the administrators.
Well, somebody was selecting well.
Well, it was a compelling lure. Fine housing, cheap housing, well, reasonable housing by the standards of the day. And you had to get out in 5 years. That was another enlightened policy. You couldn't homestead. But, we all left after 5 years, and 20 years later, our associations were still the compound. No, it was a striking contribution, and it was Worf's contribution, plus the insight of E.B. and A.W. Peterson, Galistel.
Wonder whose idea, do you know whose idea it originally was?
I've always thought it was EBs, and I've said so in writing so many times by people, but in things that have been read by people at the time, none of whom have ever contradicted me.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds just like E.B.,
mm-hmm.
who was always very conscious of the utter necessity of recruiting talent.
Yeah. Yes, you do say, talk about that in your article about him. Little monograph.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I'd like to ask you about something that Mark Ingram said, which was that there was an issue involving a blacks living at university houses that was the reason why Worf decided to get rid of the houses.
Know nothing about that.
Hmm. No.
See, it's quite possible that something as sensitive of that would be resolved short of showing up in Worf minutes.
Mm-hmm. Did you have access to correspondence as well? You must have had.
Sure.
Yes, but you're right. People wouldn't, this wouldn't have been in letters.
But I think his name was Golightly, the black living mm-hmm. in the houses.
That was at that time, was
sure.
it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's one I never heard.
Oh.
It could have... Well.
Yeah. Well, I haven't heard it from anybody else, but Mark Ingram did say it.
That surprised me. Worf had nothing to say about who got in there.
Mm-hmm.
That was run by University Housing Bureau. It's quite possible that that would have added the tensions. After all, that was 1948-49.
Mm-hmm.
But... As a resident, I never heard it as an issue.
Yeah. Was there any objection among the residents?
I never heard of
having
any.
A black there.
That would be the last thing I'd expect out of that.
It is. I would agree with you.
Yeah.
But I just.
Mm-mm. No. Mm-mm. The one. Running controversy that I went into at some length because it is so intimate an aspect of continuing Worf University relations was the question of the original embargo on the use of Worf funds for anything yeah. but research in the natural sciences.
Good. Yes, that's an important subject.
When Slichter and... well, let me back up a bit. Right from the gun, Harry Steenbach didn't want to make any money off of this thing. He wanted to turn it over to the public. But he wanted a control on it. He wanted a patent. And the reason he wanted a patent was that he wanted the licensing so conducted that oleomargarine yeah. couldn't use it.
This is pretty well covered in writing about Worf. So
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the reasons that Wendell Burge later said that Worf was in restraint of trade, well, it obviously was.
Mm-hmm.
They always said, well, no oleo manufacturer ever applied. That was because they knew darn well they'd never get a license,
mm-hmm.
but that was That was implicit. Harry was going to protect the Wisconsin dairy industry. So he wanted the patent, and he offered it to the regents.
Yeah.
But it was going to cost money to apply for a patent.
Excuse me. This.
Go further.
All right.
The regents turned this down because the Attorney General said they couldn't speculate on something like this with public money. So Harry came up with the foundation idea and sold it to Slichter and Russell. Slichter and Russell went to the regents, and part of the informal agreement with the executive committee was that the donor of the discovery could designate the field in which the profits would be spent. But that never showed up in the official agreement that the regents made, authorizing Wharf, nor in transmitting his patent to Wharf did Harry hang that on the formal transfer. In a classic letter he wrote in 1928, he did, saying that no profits from me are going to go to anything but the natural sciences. And he repeated that verbally and in numerous letters up until 1964. But the charter says nothing about the restriction. And the first violation of the embargo came in 1930 when Steenbach and Fred went to the Wharf trustees and said, look, we've got X number of new PhDs on the breadlines. Let's keep them around a year. Let's give them fellowships, postdocs. And of the, I think there were 30 that got postdocs, 5 were in the social sciences and humanities. That was the last time.
Mm-hmm.
Except for university houses, which was kind of an indirect break. In the 1950s, a bunch of young Turks, most of them university houses graduate alumni, incidentally, became very restive over this continued embargo on the use of Wharf funds, particularly when it was either Ford or Rockefeller refused to grant a big hunk of dough because they had no faith in the university administration.
Mm-hmm.
And the heat was on. And in 1957, Elvium, as dean of the grad school, reluctantly went to Wharf with a request for $25,000 for research in the social sciences, specifically to set up a mass comm research center and a survey research center. But this was outside of the normal Wharf grant, but Wharf went along.
Did they fuss about it much?
The minutes say there was extended discussion. And the board asked Ross to research this. See, the myth had grown up that there was something in the charter. And that myth had been assiduously cultivated, I must say, by the key guy in all of this, who was E.B. Fred, who was in a crucial position for a long while as dean of the grad school and then as president. Incidentally, Slichter, as early as 1932, proposed research in the social sciences.
Uh-huh.
And Wharf said, no, we don't have enough money. We got to support things that might make money. That was the... And then the myth grew that this was all in the charter. Well, Ward Ross knew damn well it wasn't, and he came back and he told the wharf board, you got to have some other reason than the charter, because all the charter says is scientific investigation and research. About the same time, the National Science Foundation decreed that quantitative research in the social sciences was, in fact, science.
I didn't know that.
And then you had these young Turks. It was Nafsinger and Karstensen and Sewell. And in the wings, Fred Harvey Harrington, who was about to take the key role. So beginning in 1957, Elvium continued to make token requests, which were accepted. I've always thought that if Elvium hadn't adopted this compromised position, he would never have made it to be president, succeeding Fred. But he was enough, he had shown enough flexibility. Then, of course, 1962, Elvium's sudden death and Fred Harvey becoming president, and just flat telling the Wharf board, you are no longer going to dictate what uses will be put to Wharf monies. This applies to anybody. It's going to apply to Wharf. And with much fussing and fuming, the Wharf board had previously, once Ross had determined this, they commissioned Ross to make a new statement. In 1932, they had officially said, it's only going to the natural resources, natural sciences. Ross drafted a turnabout statement, which was never acted on.
Mm-hmm.
But in effect, the Wharf board stood mute. They no longer dictated.
Do you remember? Do you know? Does it show up in the minutes how that actually happened? I've interviewed Fred Harrington about Wharf. But he didn't, I don't think he actually said how he did that, whether he wrote them a letter or whether he stood at the board meeting and said it.
You know, I don't know.
Because that must have been quite an event for Wharf.
What I know about that is what Fred told me.
Uh-huh.
And all he told me was that he politely but firmly told Wharf, enough is enough.
So it's not in the minutes?
Well, sure. See, in the Wharf minutes, outside of that 1931-32 statement, it never again said, now you got to use it for this. All it says is, we give the university this. It was a gentleman's agreement.
But this is take two of the interview with Clay Sheinfeld.
Now, since that classic turnaround, some members of the board have continued to be restive and have actually verbalized that they wanted to go back to the original pristine policy.
Even now?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting?
And as late as 1982 or 83, Irv had to go to great lengths to convince the board that well, one thing the board has resented is all these research funds are now intermingled once they get to the grad school in a unencumbered research funding, mm-hmm. state funds, federal, private, Wharf. And see, very, very early in the game, after E.B. Fred became dean of the graduate school, the university began never telling Worf what it was going to do with the money. It had started out saying, now we want this for this and that for that.
Yeah.
And E.B. turned that around so that the only report Worf got was after the fact. So as late as 1984, and this is in the history, Irv wrote a long dissertation explaining to the board that if they wanted to look at it that way, all the Worf money was going to the natural sciences.
Yes.
This has been a tough problem for presidents because meanwhile the legislature has been saying, what are you doing with our money? And they didn't want to support musicology. They wanted to support lice-free alfalfa.
Sure,
and
yeah.
So it's been a sleight of hand game. There have only been two occasions that I could find on the record after the initial grants where Worf said, you will do this with our money. One was in 1933, very early in the game. Harry L. Russell encouraged the board to say, you will set up this department with this money, and you will appoint this guy as the professor. That produced a big flap. And E.B. was the brand new dean of the graduate school. And he kept that money separate. He wasn't going to contaminate the rest of the show. Now, what is so very interesting is the chair that Worf created out of whole cloth was a chair in game management. And the professor that they handpicked was Aldo Leopold. And the university has been delighted, of course, in recent years that that happened. But the only other time Worf has tried to do that was in fairly recent years. They stipulated that a certain amount of money would go for a chair in nutrition research.
Oh, yes.
And the university for various reasons toe danced around that, said they could never find the right guy. What they were really saying was, this is an unwarranted intrusion on our prerogatives, and Worf withdrew the money.
But eventually it's going to happen. I mean, it is going to happen, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
They're finally doing it.
Right.
I guess Walter Frauci talked some about that.
Right. Well, that set a couple of Worf trustees on their ears. Because this seemed innocent. What's wrong with the chair of nutrition research? Well, part of the problem was where to put it. So that produced internal tensions. And Bob Bach has always been extra sensitive about Worf making even the semblance of suggesting what was going to happen to Worf money. So that produced strains. But apparently it's quieted.
So it wasn't that the medical school that was dragging its heels, but the whole university. I mean, or the graduate school.
It was Bob Bach.
I see.
Yeah. Because he's the major domo over all the funds through the research committee. But this wasn't really going to the research committee. This was a ticketed item.
Yeah.
Now, actually, Worf has given a lot of ticketed items, but that's because the university has asked for them. These are principally for buildings.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was creating the university press. Incidentally, the only thing it could print was research in the natural sciences.
Yes, I think that shows up. Where does that show up? Harrington at one point wanted money for the dissemination of scientific information. Do you remember, did you come across that phrase? It was two things he wanted. One was that, and the other was free money that he could use for fundraising trips, entertaining people. Do you go into this?
Mm-mm.
It said that doesn't show up in the minutes.
Mm-mm.
Well, Worf, of course, didn't look very kindly upon the one, and I wondered how much the other had to do with the UW Press, but it was well after the UW Press was started.
Remember, these are official minutes of the official board meetings.
Yes.
And what may be decided in one of the numerous committee meetings may never show up in the official board meetings, just like Board of Regents minutes.
Yeah.
Minutes are, unless you know what you're looking for, they are a very frail read on which to write writing a history.
Yes. I just have to...
It is very easy, since you have to rely on Madison newspapers for a good deal, and presidential files, both of which will invariably and innocently and in a degree reflect the tensions more than the normal ongoing events. And when you think that for 60 years you've had this independent organization sitting out there with lots of money, just doling it out with really minimal problems, really. That's the real story, I
uh-huh.
think.
Hmm.
When you consider the temptations.
Yes.
But it is true, the normal, everything's fine, doesn't show up in records so much. The other, we talked about the covert influence of university houses.
Mm-hmm.
Another, I think, remarkable thing that happened with the Worf money. It was fortuitous when Worf came on the scene that there was a research committee of the grad school, that it had a little practice in awarding grants. See, beginning in 1919, the state created what was called the Number 9 Fund, what E.B. Fred always called fluid money, unearmarked.
Mm-hmm.
The university could use it for any research it wanted. And the first amount in 1919 was $23,000.
Mm.
And it has grown. So how do you award it? Well, there was a research committee which had been set up 2 years before, and its mission had been to raise research money.
Oh.
Curiously, in 1917, the Navy had come to universities in the country and said, we need national defense research. Won't you do some? But the Navy didn't have any money, believe it or not. Seems incredible now. The Navy said, won't you go out and raise money? And see, 1919, that would have been Burge, 1917, maybe Van Hise, appointed a young math professor as chair of this money-raising committee, and that was Slichter. So that was his first assignment, was to go out and raise money. And incidentally, the people he went to, that he got to know, were the people he then went to raise the Wharf money.
Mm-hmm.
Haight, and Billy Kies, and Brittingham, and so on. Well, so you had this committee that had a little practice in awarding research funds. Now, these monies were so peanut. That I guess I don't know what the rationale was, but by accident or design, the committee figure said, now, you professors, just send us a memo, what you want to do, and we'll send you the money. Don't go through your department chair. Don't clutter up all the channels. Don't go through the dean. Now, the money will come back through channels. So here was this committee in place in 1925 with this procedure that faculty members could go direct to the committee. And that's what they adopted when they got the first Wharf money, which was, well, E.B. got his through Steenbach personally. But once they began to get a little money, I think the first was $13,000, then it went through this committee. Now, just stop and think what would have happened if there hadn't been that committee. It's quite possible that the Wharf money would have been divided up by school and college,
mm-hmm.
by department. As it was, you get this direct channel where faculty members can get funding without playing politics with their department chair or their colleagues or the dean or the president. Just go to this committee. So that has become a powerful committee, and it rotates. That rotation has also meant that generations of faculty learn the research capabilities. What happened to me here?
Well, as I was saying,
your chair,
that unique direct from professor to committee channel has also contributed to interdisciplinary capabilities,
mm-hmm.
in subtle but very effective ways. You can't say that's a Wharf invention, but without the Wharf money, that committee wouldn't have had the wherewithal to create this unique climate.
Mm. Was this observation about the importance of the existence of the research committee yours for this book? Or
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's an interesting contribution, mm-hmm. to the story.
Mm-hmm. I'm momentarily out of gas.
Let's see, we were you had talked about the discrete funds. On the UW Press, that certainly wasn't for the natural sciences. Or did they justify it by saying if you're going to have scientific research, you have to publish? Oh, you said they were going to have to do it all. Originally, they wanted it only to publish natural sciences. Yeah.
Yes. Now, once the press began to develop profits, then the profits it could use for other than publishing natural science. The interesting thing is today the press is self-supporting. There's no more subsidy.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the social sciences and humanities books that are supporting the hard
that
research
make the
books.
Money.
Right.
That's nice. Is there anything else on the social sciences story? It's pretty well documented. It was felt, of course, that, and you said that E.B. Fred had dragged his heels on it. I guess I can't think of anything more. In the files, the correspondence between Brittingham and Steenbach, there's a very interesting exchange of letters which shows what a very difficult time Steenbach was having in giving the board by his wishing to be there and control things, and he was apparently asked not to come to meetings. Do you go into this in your book? Why did you leave this out?
Well, all kinds of things like that I just felt were peripheral to the main story. Well, when I say that I don't go into them, I make it very clear in my book that Harry was a very tough guy to deal with.
Mm.
But then, what the hell? That was a small price to pay for what he'd given him. It got increasingly tough, but Tom was no easy guy to get along with either. These were two bandy roosters. I just didn't choose to right or wrong to air all those.
That's what I meant when I said that there is a lot of drama in the Worf story, and this would be part of it. There's a letter from Tom Brittingham to Steenbach. A long letter. Maybe you've seen
sure.
it.
Yeah.
Where he says that it's his child and he has to let it go.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I say, I could have tripled the length.
Yes. What about some of the people who've been coming in from outside to do studies of Worf? I know Sherry Epstein from
right.
Harvard
mm-hmm.
came at one point.
Right.
How is this handled, and how does Worf feel about this?
How do you mean, how was it handled?
Well, to what extent did they make files accessible to somebody of that sort?
Not at all. She had total access to everybody except the Worf executive director and the files.
Mm-hmm.
That was a board decision.
Hmm. Have there been many of besides? I know there's one other study that's been done that I know of, and there must.
What one is that?
Is it did Blumenthal?
The reference was to Edward B. Cohen, the house that Vitamin D built.
But it seems to me I have copies of two reports that were done.
Hmm.
The man who used to be in Harrington's office and is now in Maryland.
Not familiar with that at all.
It's a study of I believe of this kind of institution, and Worf is mentioned.
Okay.
See, it's not about Worf.
Oh, all right. Yeah.
Yeah.
All
sorry.
Right. What access he had, I don't know.
Yeah.
Just don't know. I had a long talk with Sherry, and so did Walter, and Dean Cronin. I guess her, they had access to the archives.
Yeah.
Talked to Bob Bach, and you've seen the final report.
Yeah.
You've also seen the there was a. An undergraduate center for public policy research or something like that in the
that Jim Rowan was
yeah you've seen that no that's you could make a whole separate human interest story sure
well I just that was a separate question well tell me if you were to describe your book, what would you say was its main content, and which of the many aspects of Worf did you include in it?
Well, there's one chapter on how Worf developed its relationships with its 14 key constituencies. Of which, obviously, the university is one. There's a chapter on how Worf raised its money, policies and practices, and there's a chapter on how the university spent it, policies and practices.
Yeah. Huh.
Preceded by the pre World War I history. That's really the framework.
Yeah. When you say it's 14 constituencies, you mean it's research lab and it's lawyers?
No.
Or?
No. Well, in inventors, licensees. I'm not going to cover them all.
Okay.
Government, press, university, medical profession. That's what I mean by constituencies.
Yeah.
The people that had to live with.
Yes.
And how it went about developing those relationships and
that's interesting. So this isn't just a chronological report.
No. It's deliberate.
Yeah.
I deliberately opted not to do that.
Because everybody else had done that, and that.
Right. No.
Means one doesn't get much of this kind of analysis usually if you do a chronological study.
No, it is. It is definitely not that. Right or wrong.
Mm-hmm. And when you say how they raised their money, do you talk about their investment strategies and who was in charge of it?
Yeah, and the other ways that it has raised money. The Dell story.
Yeah.
Other gifts. The long story of the Worf Lab.
Yes.
The Worf Institute, like so.
Yeah. What do you? The Hilldale story, does that come in? That's
no. Hilldale has nothing to do with Worf.
Well, they were asked once to give some money for it, and E.B. Fred went to them, but they didn't. So you're right.
There again. you could make a book out of the requests that Worf has turned down.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe somebody should do that.
I'm not sure that that would all show in the record.
And do you think it was, for instance, discussions of the investment strategy that would make Worf not want to have this public?
No.
In other words, you don't say anything critical or derogatory about Worf. It's just a discussion of how they do things.
No, anybody very touchy would object to various nuances, if not some direct statements.
Oh.
I'm sure. It is simply, at the present time, a majority of the board doesn't wish to call attention to itself.
Yeah,
now, remember, this was all being played out simultaneously with Worf confronting some very desperate suits, but that I won't go into because I can't.
Mm-hmm.
But you could argue, and their lawyers did, that this was not the time to focus attention on war.
Mm-hmm.
There is also, on the part of some university people, an equally paranoid feeling that if you highlight the amount of money that Worf contributes to the university, legislators will say, well, this is an easy way to save money. We'll just whack off $7 million a year because you're getting that from Worf.
Yeah.
And that has twice happened on the floor of the legislature. So this is not phony. There have been two times when legislators have said, we'll reduce the university appropriations by the amount of Worf grants. There are also faculty members who feel that other eleemosynary foundations, if they are constantly reminded of the existence of Worf, will be less inclined to be generous to Madison.
Hmm.
So,
of course, all this was in place before you wrote it, wasn't it?
Sure.
How disappointed do you feel that this, I mean, you must have worked hard at it. How
sure.
many years did you spend on it?
2.5.
That's a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And how many pages?
I guess about 400 manuscript.
Double-spaced manuscript
yeah.
pages.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a little more with the appendices.
So you put a great deal into this.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Is it among your writings? Is it one that you're particularly proud of? Or?
Sure.
Yeah.
But I've written 23 books.
Yes.
I don't need a title.
No.
That's the last thing I need. And I'm enough of a professional PR man and former university administrator, so I can understand these sentiments. I don't happen to agree with them,
yeah.
but that
yeah.
doesn't mean that I don't understand where they're coming from.
Tell me when the decision was made not to publish it.
Well, it was at a board meeting, May of 85, I guess.
When it was all finished.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we had even gotten the estimates.
I see.
The printing estimates. Sure.
How would it have affected you if you had known it wasn't going to be published in the middle?
I was being paid. It's a fascinating story. I had a good time.
Yeah.
You know, I've ghostwritten so much stuff for this institution, I would have probably done it anyway if somebody had said, well, we need something for a memo for the record.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
No, it never... that never occurred to me.
But this was more than that, wasn't it? I mean, I know...
Yeah, but... look, I spent 33 years in the Army. I understand a direct order when I hear it. I got a direct order to write it. I got a direct order to file it. I don't need any more than that. Remember, I'm not a professional historian.
Uh-huh.
There are no brownie points that I would have gotten for this.
Yeah.
Academically. Well, I have a drawer full of manuscripts if you want to see them, just because I published 23 books. Don't
you've got a lot that you haven't published,
yeah,
you mean.
Yeah, this is routine.
I see.
Yeah. And if this weren't classified, I'd print it myself. I've done that with two of my manuscripts.
Hmm.
So, no, it was... I'm stunned you'd even put that perspective on it. It just never occurred to me.
Well, if you had done something that you were particularly proud of, in any sort of thing, if you created it, you might like people to see it, or painted a picture, or... It's in that spirit that I asked the question.
I guess if this had been a one and only, yeah.
Mm.
But key people who I admire and respect saw it and signed off on it.
Yeah.
It wasn't that it was totally under a bushel.
Of course, in a way, you perhaps should be glad that it's been... It means that it does... that it's not just a whitewash and it has a...
Oh, yeah. That was one stipulation that I had, that I wouldn't have done it just as a puff job.
Yeah.
At the same time, they wouldn't have picked me if they hadn't have thought I would have exercised some discretion.
Yeah. Well, I thank you very much. I'm going to have to leave.